Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishing.
With some do's and don'ts, some rights and wrongs,
That's
some ups
right.
and downs, some lefts and rights.
That's right. And yeah. what you should eat and what you should not eat in the plant world.
Yeah, really?
Pretty good. Yeah. We're going to have Rosie Lerner on, and that's a name that Bob and I have known well for many, many years. Rosie's with the Extension Service at Purdue.
Yeah, in my mind, she's the Donna Michael of
yeah,
Hoosierdom. She knows as
so.
Much as Donna. And
yeah.
And she's got a lot of information that's really good about kind of the basic things in gardening you tend to forget or neglect or just don't do. Some mm-hmm. do's and don'ts to make your garden work year-round.
Yeah, just, you know, the kind of the concept of developing good habits.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Instead of the bad habits or the lazy habits or the I'm not going to pay attention to that right now habit.
Of which we have zip.
Right. Well, I have to say I'm pretty good about...
You're bad habitless?
No.
Okay.
But I'm pretty good habitful... In the garden. My bad habits are other places. How about that?
We're growing words here. It's like habits. Yeah.
And also joining us, an author that Bob and I really like, Amy Stewart. We talked to her a couple years ago when she wrote Flower Confidential, sort of the yeah. ugly side of the big flower business
yeah.
and the interesting side too. But she has recently penned a book called Wicked Plants, The Weed That Killed Lincoln's Mother and Other Botanical Atrocities. And just kind of talks about, you know, deadly to dangerous to illegal to this is going to give you an upset
yeah,
stomach and
invasive.
Make you throw up. Invasive, yeah,
yeah,
ill-mannered plants. But it's not this, it's a fresh look, don't you think?
It's well-written and it's fun, it's well-researched. It sounds grim, but it's not.
It's not, and it's a small book, so it's
yeah.
like it gives you like historical and cultural perspectives on plants and people, stories in the news from like a couple of years ago,
yeah.
in addition to Socrates, who had to drink poison hemlock.
And what's most amazing, our listeners will be amazed at how common some of these plants mm-hmm. are in their lives and don't
yeah.
realize how potentially dangerous or invasive or whatever
yeah.
they are.
Or that you could use them as some sort of weapon.
Don't, Janet, you're not listening, are you?
Yeah.
No, I don't want Mrs. Hill turn off the radio.
No. All right. So, yes, that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob,
yeah.
what's going on in your garden?
I'm happily planted 4, 5, 6, 8 years ago some yellow-tipped shrubs
mm-hmm.
that bloom this time of year. Or they kind of start earlier than you might imagine. They bloom
mm-hmm.
like February and March. I look out my window, and I can look across my backyard, and here's some yew and some taxus. Some other plants, it's kind of got yellow, some are totally
Poisonous.
Yellow,
mm-hmm.
and some are vivid, and
mm-hmm.
I just enjoy having that color on the far side of my
So this is foliage. Is this yellow foliage
These are
or
shrubs.
Yellow blooms?
These are shrubs. No,
so
just the foliage,
blooms,
yeah.
Just the foliage.
Just
okay.
the foliage, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm going to put some next year closer to my house outside my kitchen window mm-hmm. so I can get through January, February, and March.
It does brighten things up.
Yeah.
It really
And they're
does.
Not, they don't knock you over. They're not mm-hmm. screaming yellow. They're just kind of a pleasant yellow.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes the lawn different.
It's nice.
What's your state? What's up?
We had one pretty day. Imagine
yeah.
that, just one.
I can remember.
And it was that perfect timing where we were ready to get out and do some perennial garden cleanup. And you forget how perhaps you don't use certain muscles and move certain times of the year.
Not anymore, I don't kid.
I was so sore the next day, basically just from bending over and cutting and pulling and, you know.
Yeah.
But I was like, so my hamstrings were so sore.
Oh,
but
yeah.
we got perennial gardens cleaned up, and I took the opportunity to also say, okay, there's way too much of this perennial right here. So
Uh-oh.
Let's right now dig half the clump
Ooh.
Out. You know what I mean? And that will allow for the garden to be healthier. It will also allow for some room come spring for new plantings, that sort of thing. But I was not bashful about, all right, it's time to go because you're not quite right there. And I know you're not quite right there. And if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it.
Do you want to publicly name your victims?
There was some chrysanthemum that got a little yep. out of hand.
That's not a surprise.
Maybe some flax that had gotten pretty...
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I wasn't getting rid of them altogether, but yeah. I was just getting rid of most of them because they were too out of control.
And they're in your trunk of your car for me.
I will bring you some, in fact. We do have some in a bucket
okay.
bought next to the garage, so I'll bring you some. Because the chrysanthemum is actually a really nice one.
Unlike me to beg.
Yeah. And then we put mulch down, too. So I've, you know, taken
yeah.
care of some of my spring mulching crunch already, which
Good
is a nice
you.
Thing. So anyway, if on a pretty day, get out there, do your stretches first. And start cleaning up the garden, because the new season is about to begin again.
And speaking of things going on,
mm-hmm. we have beekeeper schools that are being offered across the state. How about that?
Yeah,
there's a couple going on, in fact. And you know, I think this is testimony to the fact that more and more people are interested in keeping bees. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture is offering some beekeeping schools on, let's see, February 20th in Whitley City. Another one February 27th in Moorhead, and then another one on March 6th in Henderson. So please do go to our website at wfpl.org or to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's website to check out more detail. But if you're interested in bees, this is where you can get a good education
on it. Sounds like fun, really.
It does sound like fun.
Wish I had more time to get into it.
Yeah. But. Yeah, well, we'll leave that up to other people and we can talk to them.
That's right.
All right. But yeah, another person that's been educating us for a long time out of Purdue University, she's joining us today, Rosie Lerner.
Yeah, we wanted to talk to somebody this time of year about the do's and don'ts of gardening, the things you should be doing and not doing on a regular basis. And nobody better than Rosie. She's been teaching the do's and don'ts of gardening at Purdue for a long, long time. She's with us today to give examples of what we should be doing in the garden and not be doing in the garden. So, Rosie, welcome to Homegrown.
Why, thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I think everybody in every field, including gardening, kind of forgets some of the do's and don'ts of things we should be doing and not doing. And it can be kind of fatal, literally, in gardening, so to speak. So, what's your thoughts about that in general? Why do people keep forgetting the do's and don'ts? Is it human nature?
Oh, I suppose so. And we're all trying to operate on short time. Many of the occasions that we're out gardening, it's, you know, the weather has just cleared up just long enough for us to get something done, and so we're always in a hurry these days. Mm-hmm. So sometimes maybe that's the reason why we forget.
So Rosie, what do you think are the top things that keep getting perpetuated over and over and over again that are just all wrong, but that's what people see everywhere, so they think it's what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, well, there's quite a few things that come to mind, judging by the kinds of phone calls we get that seem to be repeaters.
Yeah.
I guess thinking about things like trees and shrubs, I would say do your home. Well, actually, this actually holds for all plants. Do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
So know what you're planting before you put it in the ground. Particularly things like perennials and the woody plants that you're making a kind of a long-term commitment when you put those in.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to know a little bit about what you're putting in there and whether it's something you really wanted to add to your garden or not.
Mm-hmm.
The right plant, right place can go a long way towards heading off problems later on. So, again, doing your homework, if you know what kind of environment that plant needs, you can then decide whether or not you can give it that environment rather than always fighting with Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have several different choices on your property, or you may not, depending on how small a place you have or how many trees you have and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
but again, do your homework to see what those plants need and whether or not you can give them a good home.
Yeah.
And then, you know, down to the nitty-gritties of planting mistakes. People have a tendency to plant their trees and shrubs way too deep, and perennials too, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Or they start out perhaps at an appropriate level, but then they kind of kill them with kindness by burying them in mulch.
Right.
So those are some frequent problems. Or forgetting to remove the twine or the wire from the bald and burlap plants when they're putting them in the ground, and then they wonder why the tree is dying 6 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how much mulch is enough mulch? Because people tend to use about 4 feet, I know.
right. And unfortunately, that's not going to do the plants much good to be that deep. So.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, and it depends a little bit on which material you're using, but certainly no more than 4 inches, and probably 2 to 3 is plenty.
Mm-hmm. How about staking?
Well, you know, on trees in general, if you can get away with not having to stake them, it's all the better.
Okay.
Because you're going to develop a much stronger root system. And in fact, through some of the studies that they've done in studying the plants in space and so forth, the actual physical movement of the plant is actually quite important to establishing a good, strong root system.
Mm-hmm. So people stake too rigidly.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are certain situations where staking is going to be necessary, particularly, you know, in a vulnerable, windy location,
mm-hmm.
Or you're moving a particularly large plant that you're afraid the weight's going to lean over. Perhaps a light soil and heavy rainfall, those sorts of things. So you might need to stake for a while, but you want to get those stakes off as soon as you can. So probably no more than the first growing season.
Mm-hmm.
And then the general rules of pruning. You know, people always prune at the wrong time of the year. So
that was on my list, too.
Or leave a nub.
Right, yeah.
To poke you in the eye.
Well, so, yeah. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that in most cases, unless you prune very severely, plants aren't going to die because they got pruned at the quote-unquote wrong time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there is a better time to prune. And for most of the woody plants, late winter, before the new growth begins, is the ideal time to do most of your pruning jobs, particularly for the trees that lose their leaves in winter. You can much better see the architecture of the plant, so you have a better idea of what's overcrowded and what's older and not productive and needs to be removed and all that. What's been damaged by winter, though it wasn't a particularly bad winter as that goes. And we've had plentiful moisture around here.
Oh,
yeah,
you have
too. Yeah.
So that shouldn't be as much of an issue as it might be some years.
So what about the actual cut? Do you see people making mistakes with the actual cut?
Yeah, we still have a tendency to either leave too much of a stub when we cut off a limb, or we cut back too close to the point of origin. So you want to cut just above where that branch joins the trunk. There's a little bit of raised bark tissue there that we call the collar.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make your cut just beyond the collar, but so that it's reasonably flush with it.
Mm-hmm.
That way you're not leaving a stub that will decay further back, but you don't want to cut into that collar tissue because there's a very important function there of producing callus tissue that will eventually grow over the wounded area that you've made by making the cut.
Mm-hmm. So, Rosie, what about, like, people using weird tar and paints and wraps and such as, like, Band-Aids for their trees when they prune them?
We definitely do not recommend any kind of pruning paint or tar or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
The plants are pretty amazing little systems that they've worked out on their own. They actually have naturally occurring chemicals inside the tree that it will send to the wounded area and essentially from inside of the plant seal off the wound.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make your cut properly, this callus tissue eventually will form sort of like a Band-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it's a really large limb, it's going to take a few years before the callus tissue gets large enough to really cover it. But on small wounds, that actually can happen quite quickly. And that's another good reason to prune in late winter or very early spring, because the new growing season, as it begins, is a very quick time for callus tissue to form.
Yeah, and the planting itself, people tend to garden in April, May, and June and go in the house until the next April, May, and June.
Or go on vacation.
Right.
Right, absolutely.
Everything I've seen and learned is actually fall is perhaps one of the best times to plant. Why is that?
It certainly can be. Well, it depends on the year, but many times we have more cooperative weather in the fall in terms of perhaps a longer period where the soil might be moist but not overly waterlogged as it might be in spring rains. But, of course, that's quite variable from year to year as well. But we can often have a very nice, long growing season in the fall where we have warm enough temperatures to get good root growth but not so warm that the plants are under stress.
And what temperatures will roots grow at? Above what?
Well, there's probably a range that would depend a little bit on the species. We don't have a lot of good data on that. But generally, our rule of thumb is soil temperatures above 40 degrees, you should still be getting some root growth on most plants.
So that's most of the, I mean, for us at least down here, that's most of the year. You know what I mean?
Quite a bit of the year.
Yeah.
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 But, of course, in summertime,
they'll slow down because it's warm.
It's very hot, and there's a huge demand for water going through the plant. Plants are always taking in water and losing it as transpiration, meaning water vapor into the air, which is a good thing. That's what keeps plants upright and not wilted.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as water moves into the plants, into the roots, it's also bringing up some mineral nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good thing and very necessary for plants to survive. But if the root system is compromised, it will lose water faster than it can take it up.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, sometimes fall planting, you can get a better root establishment because the fall weather may be less demanding on the water resources. But that's not always the case. You have to kind of play that by ear from year to year.
Mm-hmm. So what about fertilizer do's and don'ts? Mostly, don't you think people are maybe overdoing it?
Yeah,
more than other people
absolutely.
Probably aren't doing it at all or not understanding what their options are.
Absolutely. And I'd say for new gardeners, mm-hmm. particularly whether you're talking about a vegetable garden, flower beds, shrub beds, whatever that is, if this is a new property for you or a new bed that you're establishing, it's a really good idea to do a soil test just to have some idea of what you're starting with.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, you don't have to do it every year. In fact, for an established garden, once every 5 years or so is probably plenty.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a tendency to oftentimes just apply a general all-purpose fertilizer that has, you know, everything in it. And in many cases, an established garden may not need any phosphorus added at all. Phosphorus is not terribly mobile in the soil, although when it's overdone, it certainly can move off target and get
into our
the drainage water.
Let's talk about the lawn in that regard. A lot of times in the spring, you'll see these weed and feed things come out and mm-hmm. these big trucks in the neighborhoods. And we generally feel that you're better off fertilizing the lawn in the fall. Is that mostly correct?
Well, it really depends on kind of a multi-staged approach. If you were only going to fertilize once a year on your lawn, fall would be the most important time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
For some of the reasons we just talked about in terms of promoting good root growth and recovery from summer drought and all that sort of thing. If you are more into the higher maintenance lawn, which would not include myself.
No, nor us.
No.
I don't want to have to mow any more often than I do now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you were, you know, more into that the really manicured look and you don't mind doing all that mowing, then maybe two applications a year, one in the spring, one in the fall. And sort of the Cadillac version, if you will, of lawn care would probably be more like three applications a year. So one in perhaps mid-spring, one in late spring, and then another one in the fall.
So what else stands out for you as a good lesson to the general gardening populace that,
yeah.
you know, these are really good practices to hone your skills. These are really bad practices to kind of shed as the year progresses.
Well, I think in particular this past year we had a lot of new people coming into gardening. I think perhaps to supplement their food supply.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of renewed interest in vegetable gardening in particular that brought some new people into the gardening fold. And a couple of things come to mind there. One is that people have a tendency, and this is true of all gardeners, not just new gardeners, but people have a tendency to be very gung-ho, as Bob was just talking about. They garden in March and April, maybe May,
wow.
and then they disappear for months.
Mm-hmm.
People are usually very enthusiastic coming out of winter. They just can't wait to get out there and get these gardens planted. And particularly for new gardeners, they have a tendency to make things way bigger than they're really prepared to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
And then dry weather comes in, or hot, wet weather, whatever it is, and there's lots of weeds, and there's insects, and there's disease, and they just can't keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So
small.
Start small. You can always make it bigger later. Sketching your plans on paper. Now, this is one of those do as I say, not as I do. I'm really bad about not sketching my ideas on paper.
Yeah.
I do try to make notes when something is whatever, out of place, or, you know, I know I'm going to want to get back to it later. I try to make a note on a calendar somewhere that says, do this. But I'm really bad about planning things out. And then it comes back to bite me later,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't have the space to do everything I thought I wanted to do. I really don't need to add any more plants to my garden. It's way too full now. So I really need to get rid of some things before I add some things. And so if I would make sort of a battle plan, then maybe I would have room to add the new things that I want.
Well, having said that, I mean, one of my mantras is plant something new every year, at least one plant to try it just to see how it does and or doesn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Take the chance.
Yeah, and I think I really like that idea for the vegetable garden in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like I say, right now I'm at a point where I really shouldn't be adding anything new until
you can get rid
out.
Of something now.
Okay.
But that, there's no reason why that can't happen.
Right.
And I think for me that's probably a little bit easier. But
yeah.
for a lot of people, getting rid of a plant that otherwise is an okay plant is a very difficult concept. You know, or you've planted things way too close,
yeah.
and now it needs to be thinned out. That is very, very difficult for most people to wrap their minds around.
That comes
not
with
me.
Time, though. After a while, get the shovel and the chainsaw and move on.
I'm really good at that.
Yeah. Yes.
Rosie.
Not everybody shares.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you again. You're a genius at this stuff, and we appreciate you talking to us.
We do indeed.
You're quite welcome.
Purdue Extension Advisor Rosie Lerner has been teaching the do's and don'ts of gardening for about 10,000 years. For more information on Rosie or what to do or don't, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, author Amy Stewart and Wicked Plants, the weed that killed Lincoln's mother and other botanical atrocities. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown.
I'm Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
You're looking a little bit wicked today, Miss Wishy.
Oh, yes.
In a nice sort of way.
In a nice sort of way, sure. Yeah. We both enjoyed this book. Great book. Like little stories, puts it into cultural, historical perspective, contemporary perspective about how some plants have been used as poisons, how they've been used as illegal drugs, as stimulants, all kinds of stuff. But just the power of nature, I think, is really what Amy is trying to get across. And she's joining us today to talk about her new book. She is also, Amy Stewart, the author of Flower Confidential, The Earth Moved, which was about earthworms, and then From the Ground Up, which are kind of garden essays. But she's just released Wicked Plants, The Weed That Killed Lincoln's Mother and Other Botanical Atrocities. And she's joining us here today to talk about the dangers nature can deliver. Amy, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Good to have you back. First question, why tackle the subject of wicked plants?
This is kind of my dark side coming out a little bit. It sort of appeals to the same part of my psyche that is into murder mysteries. Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of like the idea that the plant kingdom has a dark side. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be fun to explore that, but also to really explore it from the perspective of the way these plants have impacted people. I mean, this is really more a book about people than plants, in a way.
Yeah, I see that, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by your research. You went through obituaries and read stories, and I see you huddled in a dark chair in a dark room looking up evil things. How long did it take you to find all this stuff?
I spent about a year doing research for the book, and you're exactly right. It really was a matter of doing things like going through obituaries, because for every plant that I wanted to include, I had to have a great story to go with it. So
I was
always looking for that victim or that villain. And that meant doing a lot of research that really had nothing to do with plants and had everything to do with people getting into lots of trouble.
Yeah. Well, and I think what I enjoyed, too, is that the backstory from Socrates all the way up to something that just happened last year kind of thing. So it's a historical as well as a contemporary look at the impact that some of these plants have had on humans.
Yeah, that was really important to me. I didn't want to make it seem like these stories all happened in the distant past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did have kind of a serious message here as well, which is that, you know, these plants are all around us all the time. And people really do get hurt, you know. Mm-hmm. Nibbling an unfamiliar plant when you're on a hike is not a 100% safe thing to do. So I wanted a few very contemporary stories that would make people go, oh, yeah, this is happening today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, were you surprised at the number? Like, there's a quote or a figure in your book, 68,847 people injured by plants and only 3,900 by electrical shock, which is a shock in itself. I mean, the number is kind of astounding when you look at it like that.
Yeah, I was trying to make the point, especially for parents with kids, that, you know, we go to such great lengths to protect our kids. And we, you know, those little plastic covers you put over electrical outlets?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
People are so concerned about things like that and do so many safety measures, and yet we'll very often leave a poisonous plant growing right by their front door and just think, oh, what could possibly happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's this idea we have that if it's from nature, if it's a plant, then it is somehow inherently safe and even good for us. So, I included that figure, that 68,000 figure. That's the number of plant poisonings that are reported every year to poison control centers.
And then on the flip side, too, your message is not one to fear all plants everywhere all the time, either.
Yeah,
but
not
just to
at
be
all,
aware
you know,
of.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me most as I was working on this book is that, you know, plants, because they're rooted in the ground, don't have a lot of ways of protecting themselves. I mean, if you're a plant, you would rather not get eaten. That's a pretty important part of getting through the day, is to figure out a way to not get eaten. And since you can't run away and hide, you employ these defense mechanisms. You have thorns, you produce poisons, you try to punish anyone who tries to eat you. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's really surprising that there's anything at all in the plant kingdom that we can eat. Because it really, in some ways, you know, rarely does it benefit the plant for us. Now, birds may be a different story. Birds eat berries to help scatter seeds. But for humans, we're lucky that there's so much that is good for us in the plant world, but there's plenty that isn't. And so I think the thing to remember is just that most of what grows out of the ground is not food for us. That doesn't mean you have to be terrified of it any more than you're terrified of the pencils and pens and paper sitting on your desk. Those things are not to be feared. They're just not to be eaten. You know?
Right. So, Amy, you sort of set up criteria in terms of what a wicked plant is, in fact. You know, not all of them are going to be deadly, but, you know, some are deadly, some are just dangerous, some are, like, illegals. There's the ill-mannered wicked plants like kudzu, that sort of thing. So what are those different, I guess, definitions to qualify as a wicked plant?
I really wanted to cast a pretty broad net with this book. So obviously I included plants that have killed people, plants that have been used as murder weapons, plants that are very, very painful, plants that will make you sick. You know, they're not going to kill you, but they're gonna make you pretty sick. And some invasive plants, I obviously didn't include them all. I mean, one thing about this book is that it's a little book. It's kind of a small, gifty size. And because of that, I was restricted. I could only include so many plants. So I included the invasive plants that were so invasive that they were creepy. You know, they seemed to have this life of their own. They seemed to have this evil plan for the world. So, like, it had to scare me in order for me to include it.
What would some of those be?
Well, I did include kudzu as something that grows incredibly fast, and also something that we ourselves introduced to this country. This plant did not get here on its own. We did this, and I always like that human connection. Also, killer algae was one of my favorites. It's essentially a seaweed, but one individual plant, one individual little seedling in an aquarium in Germany mutated so that it could live in much colder water than it normally could, and that allowed it to really take over a lot of ocean habitats that it wouldn't have otherwise.
So does the killer algae kill fish because it grabs up the oxygen, or does it kill them through some sort of poisonous mechanism?
Yeah, it's actually poisonous to fish.
Okay.
And it also smothers ocean life. I mean, it can grow 20 to 30 feet deep on the ocean floor, so as you can imagine, it kills everything else.
And it grows quickly?
It grows very rapidly, yeah. There was actually a patch of it discovered off the coast of San Diego, and they tarped over it and injected chlorine into it to kill it. So that gives you an idea of how bad it is. Like, it's better to put chlorine in the ocean than to have this plant there.
And then closer to home, like the purple loosestrife, the plant that ate Minnesota, it's got 2.5 million seeds per plant.
Yes, I did include that one in part because it is so beautiful that we were sort of lulled into a sense of complacency with it for a long time.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, even through the 80s, I read garden writers. I went back through old newspapers and looked at how garden writers talked about this plant, and they would call it a handsome rascal, like like it's a bad boy, but we still kind of love it. So so we really allowed that plant to go crazy because we couldn't resist how gorgeous it was. I also included some plants that were offensive in some way, like plants that smell terrible, plants that explode, plants that catch on fire. So just plants that are gross or you know, just revolting in some way.
Yeah, the gas plant.
That's right.
You also included plants that are significant sources of allergies.
Yeah.
And ragweed is one of them. And I know that that's, you know, something that lots of people around here suffer. But there were other surprising ones as well. What were some of the top allergen plants?
Yeah, some of these did really surprise me. One of them that took me by surprise was the olive tree. You know, I mean, certainly in the South and throughout the West, olive trees are a beautiful outdoor plant in the landscape. And they contain so many different allergens within the pollen that a very broad spectrum of people are highly allergic to them. And, you know, even elsewhere where they're more of a conservatory plant, you know, you might grow it in a conservatory, a citrus tree and an olive tree.
Mm-hmm.
That pollen is quite deadly. So that was one that really surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think in general with these plants that cause allergies, again, this is a situation where people are strangely reluctant to take some action for themselves. I've met a lot of people who have serious seasonal allergies. They're homesick. The kids get sick. Everybody's doped up on cold medicine and allergy medicine trying to get through the season. And I look outside, and it's very easy to spot the offender because mm-hmm. it's covered with pollen, you know, this yellow pollen all over everything. And it's like, cut that tree down.
Well,
don't plant something that won't make you sick. I mean, it's not a heritage oak. It's not the plant that your grandfather brought from the old country. It's just some random thing that the contractor put in the ground when your subdivision was built.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
Well, and lawn grasses, Bermuda grass, I was surprised, Kentucky bluegrass, top allergens as well in certain parts of the country.
That's right. And, of course, the thing with grasses is that you want you don't want them to bloom. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's the issue. But the problem is that it's one thing for you to keep your own lawn mowed such that your grasses don't bloom, but, you know, are all your neighbors going to do that consistently? Maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Another figure that astounded me, not to neglect ragweed entirely, was a billion hunks of pollen per plant on a ragweed. It's just astounding.
Yeah. It is astounding.
Man, no wonder.
And they blame it all on goldenrod.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right, allergens. How about things that are basically just good old garden staples? The hydrangea, I was surprised, had some toxic properties.
Yes, I included a little section of very common garden plants that a lot of people grow that have some kind of toxins in them. And in the case of hydrangeas, they contain cyanide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they only contain a little bit of cyanide. But in my opinion, you know, even a little bit of cyanide is something that you want to be aware of and you want to think about. And I see hydrangea blossoms used as cake toppers on wedding cakes all the time.
Right.
And it's not like if you have one little slice of wedding cake that was in contact with a hydrangea that, you know, your entire wedding party is going to fall over dead or anything like that. But I do think that it's useful to point that out, particularly since edible flowers are such a popular thing. I think people walk outside and think that all flowers must be edible. Why wouldn't they be? They're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. How could it not be okay to eat them? And so this is a good example of one that, well, yeah, it's got a little cyanide in it.
Yeah, and then monk's hood, that surprised me.
Oh, monk's hood is one of my
super
favorite
dangerous
plants in the book,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Aconitum. Very, very toxic. And in fact, you know, I grow it in my garden. I have a little poison garden full of all these.
Of course you would.
Of course I would. I know. And but I really have gotten to be very careful around that plant. I always wear gloves and just really watch myself. It really goes to work on the nerves. It can cause paralysis. It can cause a dangerous drop in blood pressure, and it can eventually kill a person. And I did find a couple of cases of people who mistook monk's hood for something edible. It has that long taproot. It could look like a carrot. It could look like parsley. And it is quite deadly.
Hmm.
And three others I've planted all the time and never thought about was datura or angel's trumpet and castor bean, and then the beautiful fragrant Daphne. That surprised me.
Yeah, you know, so here's an interesting story about Daphne. I was in the Pacific Northwest up in Seattle and met a guy who's a very well-known nurseryman, a real plant expert who has a garden full of wonderful and interesting plants, and one of them is just this gorgeous Daphne. And he came home from work one day, and his wife said, honey, is it okay that our daughter's been eating Daphne berries? And he said, what? No, it's not okay. She was about 3 years old, and they induced vomiting. They got immediate medical attention, and she was okay, but she had ingested well more than a fatal dose of Daphne berries. And her mother, even living with someone who's a really renowned plantsman, didn't know that and sort of, you know, stood idly by while her daughter was, you know, essentially swallowing poison.
Oh, my gosh. Right.
Well, have there been documented cases of the castor bean or the angel's trumpet, the datura, actually putting people in the hospital?
Oh, well, sure, yeah. I mean, the thing about castor bean is that it contains the poison ricin.
Okay.
Those seeds are very, very toxic, and it would only take one or two of them chewed well. You kind of do need to chew them up to break the seed coat. That's all it would take to kill a person. It really does not take much with castor bean.
Wow. Huh.
And the thing about Datura is that all of those Daturas, you know, they're all nightshades, and there are a lot of poisons in the nightshade family, and they cause hallucinations and ultimately respiratory distress, that you can be sent into a coma, and that can kill you as well. Mm-hmm. What I hear more about, I mean, most of the cases of people being hospitalized, they're able to be treated and released, but very dangerous, frightening symptoms.
Mm-hmm. One of the more famous people that are included in the book for dying is Abraham Lincoln's mother. Can you tell us the story and sort of the connection between animals eating white snake root and then it being consumed by people, because it's not like she was out there eating white snake root.
Right, yeah. So white snake root is, in fact, the weed that killed Lincoln's mother, which is the subtitle of the book. And so here's what happened. In the early 1800s, there was a very mysterious ailment called milk sickness. Occasionally, people would drink milk and get very sick and die, and nobody knew what caused it. It was very frightening. But there also didn't seem to be much that anyone could do about it. It's not like you could just stop drinking milk, because people needed all the food they could get in those days, really kind of living off the land. And it turned out that the culprit was white snake root. Cows would go graze on this plant. It was very toxic for the cows. The cows would get sick. The poison would end up in their milk, and people would drink the milk and get sick, and in many cases die. And this is how Abraham Lincoln's mother died in the early 1800s.
You never hear about that.
And,
that
you know, the thing about that is, this was at a time when, first of all, cows were pretty much free to wander around and eat whatever they could find to eat in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you drank milk, you were probably drinking the milk of just the one cow. Your family had a cow, and that's where your milk came from. It's not like it was combined with the milk of millions and millions of other cows like it is today.
Mm-hmm.
But it took until, you know, really the early 1900s before we knew what was causing it and were able to really disseminate that information across the United States.
Did you develop like a deadly plant meter, like the poison arrows, which I would think would be among the most poisonous use of plants ever, but talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this was interesting. You know, anytime I could find a plant that had been used as a weapon, that really intrigued me, because, you know, the plant itself might be toxic enough, but you combine it with someone who's got an urge to murder or an urge to go to war, and you've really got something bad.
Yeah.
So there's actually several plants that have been used as arrow poisons over the years, where you sort of, maybe you make a paste or a liquid out of the plant and coat your arrow in it, and so there's a vine in South America called curare, which is actually it's like a muscle relaxer. It will actually paralyze your prey, and so hunters would use it because it could stop an animal in its tracks and let them go catch up with it.
Sure, yeah. All right, some other famous stories. I liked the story of how Jimson weed got its name, and then how, in fact, it was used by early colonizers to sort of stave a little bit of the British invasion.
Yeah, this is a very interesting one. So when the first group of colonists arrived at Jamestown, you know, it's kind of funny looking back on it. My ancestors were among, you know, some of the early groups of Europeans to come over, and I look back and I think, boy, we really did not send our best and our brightest.
Yeah.
Necessarily. let's be honest. They showed up and took a look at Jamestown Island and said, well, this looks great. There's nobody living here. Why don't we settle down here? Well, there were lots of reasons why nobody was living there. The water was brackish. They could not get clean water. It was overrun by mosquitoes, and there was this very poisonous plant all over the place, which was a type of datura.
Mm-hmm.
We now call it Jimson weed, but that probably originated as Jamestown weed.
Oh,
and it's a hallucinogen. The first people who might have tried to eat it would have gotten very sick and gone kind of crazy for a while, and it certainly could have killed someone if they ate enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are stories about the first wave of British soldiers who showed up to try to quell these early uprisings among the colonists, and the colonists slipping them a little bit of Jimson weed in their food just to try to slow them down some. And sure enough, it made the British soldiers go crazy for a little while, which gave the colonists some time to get themselves organized.
The upper hand,
yeah. Yeah, Lowell was very proud of his Olmsted Park system, and by golly, he almost went blind getting too close to a plant.
I know. I thought this was so fascinating. So when Frederick Law Olmsted was 14, he stumbled into some poison sumac, got it in his eye, and actually missed about a year of school. I mean, his vision was that messed up. And he kind of, looking back, attributed his love of plants to the fact that he was free to roam around and kind of do whatever he wanted for a year while his eye was healing up. But he always had problems with his eyes, and he blamed it on the poison sumac. He thought that he never quite got over that. So it's ironic that the father of landscape architecture was almost blinded by a plant.
Okay. So, Amy, one more kind of category to look into: food items and preparation. I think people would be really surprised that cashews are in the same family as poison sumac and poison ivy and that sort of thing. Kidney beans, corn, potatoes. Let's talk a little bit about how they could potentially be poisonous if not prepared properly.
Yeah, you know, and this is another one where I thought, oh, I want to have a whole section. So I called this deadly dinner. It's all kinds of foods that we sort of take for granted, but that really do need to be processed in some way. Now, the thing about cashews is that they are related to poison ivy and poison oak and poison sumac. You will never see cashews in a shell. If you think about it, you've never seen a cashew shell in the grocery store. And that's why. Every part of that plant has the same toxicity as something like poison ivy, except for the little nut. And they actually have to steam them open, because if they had workers cracking them open all day long, they'd just be covered in this rash.
Wow. And one other category I was thinking of, these indoor plants, the household plants, can be dangerous too.
Yeah. For instance, the ficus tree I thought was a really interesting one. I found a story of a woman who'd been very sick for a very long time. Nobody could figure out what was wrong with her. And and one day she happened to get rid of her ficus tree for no particular reason, just, you know, she was moving or whatever, she needed to clear out some space, she got rid of it, and her symptoms went away immediately. And it turns out that she had a very severe latex allergy.
Wow.
And it was that plant that was making her sick. Now, most house plants are not going to make you fall over dead, but if you were to nibble on them, you'd get a very sore throat, you'd get an upset stomach, you might have an allergic reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Huh. I'm going to move to a condo and sell my plants.
Oh, no, you're not. This was fascinating. I really enjoyed this book. And I think, you know, the backstory behind some of the ways that plants are used is really what makes it. Well done, Amy. Thank you. It's entertaining and informative. We appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a lot of fun with it.
Great. Amy Stewart is a best-selling author of 4 books, including Wicked Plants, The Weed That Killed Lincoln's Mother, and Other Botanical Atrocities. Of course, for more information on Amy Stewart and her book, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And we've got a question that actually is one of those delightfully sad questions, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's a well-written question. We're going to deal with it.
All right.
A woman named Lori. Uh-huh. She wrote, it's a funny question. I am in dire need of guidance and instructions on what to do with my immense mole population. Mm-hmm. Of the 5 years I've lived here, this past year has been the year of destruction. It has never been so bad. The dogs are readily responding to their presence, and what was naturally a beautiful, wildly laid grassy yard has turned into an ugly battle zone of nature moles versus nature dogs. It looks like a dome cemetery. It's been evacuated in no specific order.
Oh, no.
Initially, I wanted to live in peace with these moles. I no longer feel this way. I just want to kill them in a peaceful manner. Everyone tells me traps are the only way that works, but I shouldn't use them because of the kids and the dogs. Another person told me about using juicy fruit gum. I just cannot see myself trying to search sticks of gum over a 5-acre lot.
No kidding.
Help, please. Is there a chance that changing the chemistry of the soil will decrease their population. Thank you, Lori.
Lori, there's no chance that changing the chemistry of the soil will decrease their population. This year was probably the worst, Bob, just because our weather was so agreeable.
Yes.
You probably have good soil, so lots of earthworms, maybe some grubs, but they really love earthworms. So the better soil you have, the more moles you have. Look on the bright side. Usually in the summertime, we go through a droughty period. So, you know, the soil gets so hard that the moles move down a little further, so you don't see them as much. And quite frankly, the traps really are the only way to get rid of them.
I've moved on to peaceful coexistence, really. I've got 8 acres of mounds. I just kind of live with them. Eventually, they seem like they're not as bad anymore, and they go away, and or at least the mounds go away. The traps are the only answer I know.
They are. And, you know, you can reasonably use traps around kids and dogs, depending on what your kids and dogs do and all that. I mean, you have to make that choice whether or not you trust each's behavior around them. But it's not like the traps are sticking out, you know, with spears out of the ground.
No, they do their wicked deed below ground, so they ought to be safe.
But traps have to be set expertly, really, to actually trap the mole. So you are in a tough position. You can use castor oil-based products that can deter moles, but over a large area, I don't think that's practical for you, so... Yeah, sorry, traps.
But just don't leave Utica Township.
No,
we need
that's the most important part.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine that can make mountains out of molehills, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-814-8246.
Bob, it's a plant story week. What do you have for us?
I pushed the envelope this week.
All right.
I got three plants.
Oh, not like you do any other week?
No.
Okay.
I pushed my diction envelope.
Okay.
This week. Big time, yeah.
All right.
Heuchera.
Okay.
Heucherella.
Uh-huh.
Tiarella.
All right.
They're all pretty close, as you know that. And they're almost interchangeable, really. They're, even as we speak, there's just too many of them. Some mad horticulturist is out there creating
mixing
more of these things
matching.
All the time. Yeah. And they're hard to keep apart, as we'll get into it later. But the common name is interesting. Heuchera is called the coral bells, of course, or the alum root. So it's got a bitter root that's used in medicines and so forth. Yeah. The tiarella is the foam flower. Mm-hmm. We all know about that. And the heucherella is the heucherella.
Is the heucherella. could be like you got to come up with something between coral bells and
yeah, exactly.
Foam.
It's sort of a cross between like the mad scientist couldn't stop. You could have a movie on this, the attack of the horrific heucherellas. It's just
heucherella.
They just keep making these things. And
sounds like a relative of Fonzie's.
But I use them a lot. They have excellent foliage. They do well in the shade, and they can produce masses of flowers that do remind you sort of coral bells. They clump. It's best to divide them every 3 years or so. But it is hard to tell them apart because they've been overdone. So I looked up in Alan Armitage's book, and I learned two things. How you can tell them apart.
Oh, yeah?
The heuchera will have obviously lobed leaves, and tiarella can be lobed or harp-shaped.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
Okay.
I know. But this is something I learned was interesting. The best plants for this area are the heuchera villosa. Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
They hold up better to heat and humidity.
Okay.
Several people.
Is that like Purple Veil and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because those are the only ones I have.
If you're going to get a heuchera, get a villosa.
Okay.
Heuchera is named for an 18th century German physician, Johann Heinrich von Heucher.
Okay.
He apparently had a medicinal garden at his university. It was used by the Native Americans, you know this, for swelling and minor bleeding. And it is used in a salad. It's got a slightly sour taste to the leaves. Used in a sour sandwich or a salad. Not me, of course. This is really cool. Tiarella is named for the Greek tiara, as in the headdress
of
flowers.
The thing that you put on your head.
Yeah. I never thought about that. The heucherella is on its own. There's no reason for it to exist.
Okay.
But it does come with a poem.
Okay.
Let's talk of three plants under one umbrella, the heuchera, the heucherella, and the tiarella, each with lovely foliage just right for the shade and becoming much too popular within the trade. For even as you buy six in the nursery store, some mad scientist is home creating more, bent over some pollen in the laboratory for personal profit and plant world glory. To which I say in my poetic rant, we just don't need another plant that few of us can identify or hardly even want to try. With this little ditty, we can all concur especially Dr. Johann Heinrich von Hückerer.
So the poor
guy.
Hückerella.
Yeah, leave him out.
Oh, man.
Do you have any Hückerellas? Would you know?
No, I wouldn't. Well, I have Hückerellas, and that's it.
Yeah.
I'm a Hückerer girl, thanks very much.
I've heard that said about you.
Only Hückerellas.
Okay.
I don't even have any Tiarellas. All right. Probably more than you needed to know.
Yeah, right.
And thank goodness this ends another edition of Homegrown. We do hope that you enjoy us again next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the Hückerist Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.